I had this idea. I wanted to play a video because I think it hits home anything that we're going to talk about almost more than anything I could say. But I'll describe it because it is pretty easily describable. It's a school board meeting. A school board had voted to remove certain materials from their school library because a lot of parents had thrown a fit because they found some of the books that were discovered were accessible to fifth and sixth graders that had just unbelievable things in them, disgusting things that really, I mean, obviously adults shouldn't even be looking at, but anyone objectively would agree, completely inappropriate for children, actually illegal to give to children. But yet it was done in literature for a book targeted the drawings on the cover, the everything about it was labeled as for young adults for this age group. And that was just one of the books. There were other books that had all sorts of junk in it, but the one that was really the crux of it and is the reason that the school board immediately removed it. Now, this is a public school. A school board, I believe, was actually Democrat-controlled. So this isn't even a Republican-controlled school board. It was in South Carolina, and so they voted, it immediately gets pulled, and the English teachers decide that they need to get organized because book banning is happening, and this is just the most awful thing ever, and we need to have access to book. Now, regardless of where you might fall on book banning, you know, as far as if we're talking about books for adults, it is a totally different conversation and discussion than when we're talking about books accessible for somebody else's children that are underage. And so automatically, we're not even talking about the same stuff when they say banning books, but they pull in a lot of heated language that is from that discussion, and it's a historical discussion that has been a problem and abused many times, book banning or book burning or whatever you want to call it. And they pull it in and we're talking about an elementary school library, which is insane. So the English teachers get organized. They bring in students from these schools, from the junior high school, to speak to the powers that be, the school board, and to give it to them, you know, about how intrusive and controlling and backward they are, and they're engaging in book banning, and they're fascists and all this other stuff. So this daughter gets up, this girl, she's probably seventh or eighth grade, and very well spoken. She has a little speech that she's written. She tells everybody that at the beginning that she's written it. And she just launches into this diatribe about how dare you limit our educational abilities, like to learn new things, and you're failing us and yourselves by caving to the political, you know, times and the fascism that is on the rise, and on and on and on. Use all these big words. Like I said, sounds very, like, very educated. Very smart, sharp-looking young girl speaking to adults. I mean, very competent. And she explains as she's giving her speech, you know, I have had the best teachers I've ever had were my English teachers. They inspired me and helped nurture me into who I am today, to give me even the ability to, you know, write and speak like this. And everything she's saying, she's backing up. And then she uses the rest of the speech to say, and I understand where this is coming from because I deal with this at home. My father is an ignorant, racist, sexist, I mean, just piles on everything you can think of and goes into detail. She goes right to politics. He even supported Trump. He, and on and on and on. And literally throws her father under the bus for I don't even know how long of the speech. I mean, he is just the most awful person. And then she goes, he's a great dad, and he's always been loving and cared for me and supportive, but he's a terrible individual. His morals are awful, and you're caving to people like him, and they're backwards, you whatever. You know, anyway, and I wish I could play it for you because the shocking nature of hearing a child, really, publicly denounce and dishonor their parent, who they admit in front of everybody is loving, caring, supportive, has always provided for them, has never, you know, abused or done anything. You know? And the idea that somewhere along the way, this person was steered and molded and modeled into that, and into that worldview, that frame of where like I said, it's not that, you know, it'd be one thing if she's like, he's always been mean to me, he's abusive, he's controlling. She admits, oh no, he's a great dad, he's very loving and supportive. And then, but he's on and on. And then it's because of the contradiction of the worldviews. She got one worldview at home, and she got one worldview at school, and she has fully integrated the one from school into her moral, spiritual, philosophical worldview. Like, they're right. This is morally correct and superior. This is truth. And this is not just wrong, but evil. I mean, she used evil words to describe her father and his worldview and how the school board is like caving to him and these crazy parents. And so I think it's very relevant. It popped in my head today as I was looking over this. I was like, it's perfectly relevant to a discussion on Christian education, because more and more that is becoming the norm for the product of public education. And I'm not going to, I'm sure there may be public educators in the room. I'm not trying to disparage people working in public education. We need good people in public education. It's a huge mission field. However, it is a minefield for any child that is trapped in it. And I'm going to use very inflammatory language like that. I do believe that we are at that point with most public schools where that is a fair assessment of the situation. Most parents, especially people my age and my generation, I can pick on it because it is my generation, I think are woefully ignorant of the problems. You have a whole lot of people that millennials, will just throw the word out there, that came through and had private education, had the benefits and protections of it, and now they don't really know any different. And it's very in vogue to be like, oh, it doesn't matter. It's expensive. It's a luxury. Why bother? Like, the public education really isn't that big of a deal. My kids will be fine. Anyway, a lot of other objections that we can talk about. But it's becoming more and more common, and even within Christian circles, to have that viewpoint. Now, at the same time, there's some positive trends because of COVID and some parents being able to see what was actually being taught, and because of the accessibility of virtual learning, there's actually been an explosion of homeschooling and in certain places of private schooling, though in many other places, private schooling is actually declining. So it's kind of depends on where we're talking about. It's hard to talk about trends overall. But is private schooling, homeschooling, any kind of alternative education to public education, is it worth it? Is it a worthwhile endeavor? My background on the subject, and I've talked about this before, this subject, it was a little different, my angle at it. At the time, I was actually serving on, I think I was the third ranking member on the education committee in South Carolina. So I was literally running funding and overseeing public education in South Carolina. Now, I was one of many members on the committee, so I did not get to decide all of what we were doing for Education South Carolina, or I can guarantee you it would be quite different than how it was. But I was one of the members who had input on that, especially with policies and with funding. And I was someone who had gone through public education for law school. I went to USC. So I've been through 3 years of that whole system and all of my professors being liberal. I had one professor of the entire school was a professed conservative. I had him for income tax, and I had him for income tax. I only had him for half the year because he actually passed away. He had a big medical issue and dropped out, and the person that came and replaced him was a flaming liberal. So I'd literally taken the class so that I could at least have one conservative just to get some kind of an alternative opinion, because politically, and this is more, I'm in a political hat right now, so don't let that taint the rest of it if you're of a different political stripe. But for me, I wanted at least somewhat of a balanced, opinion in law, and I did not have that. I was at one of these, arguably, one of the more conservative law schools in the country, USC meaning South Carolina, I should clarify because I'm not in the South right now. South Carolina is supposedly one of the more conservative law schools, and yet as I just mentioned, there wasn't a single member of the faculty except for one who was a professed conservative. And in my tenure there, for 3 years and however many credits I had to take, I did not have one, a single conservative other than him for part of a semester. And not only were they not conservative, the majority of them were aggressively anti-conservative, and a good chunk of them were anti-Christian, just blatantly anti any kind of objective morality, any kind of they would spend time critiquing and trying to undermine any kind of worldview that came from that. So you can imagine, if that's supposedly one of the more conservative law schools, you can just imagine what it's like there out there for people educating the people who are supposed to be the defenders and upholders of our legal system. So a little concerning, right? if you think about it, and also might help you explain, I don't know how many of you know many lawyers, but it might explain to you the state of law and the profession as a whole. There are some good ones, but on the whole, most have problems, especially, we'll say, moral and ethical problems. It's because in law school, they teach you that everything's gray, that you have to be very comfortable in the gray areas, and that's, you know, how you thrive, and there's no absolute morality. And which I will say, this is off topic, but is it not the height of irony that you have the system that is teaching law and the basis of legal structures, and they're teaching them that there's no absolute morality? Because every single area of law is morality. Like, law is morality that's based on moral codes. Like, if you're going to have, especially criminal law, the most obvious one, somebody did something wrong, oh, moral judgment, and we're going to punish them. Moral judgment with a moral consequence. You take morality out of it, there is no really strong argument for why punishment is acceptable. There's really not one. Now, you could have to repayment and stuff like that, like tort law, which is when you have accidents and all that. Maybe you could say that it's you're just trying to society allocate the best organization that it can. That's what the I'm really off topic, but that's what like social Darwinists and people that kind of started a lot of the trend towards the secular system we have now, where most people teach that there is no absolute morality, which is insane. But that's where we are, and that all comes from, oh, well, society just needs to be ordered in as best a way possible, and we all agree to things. It's not based on moral absolutes. It's just based on what's the best or good for the most people, is how they understand it. But every other area of law, I mean, contract is you break a promise, you keep it. That's a moral consequence. Constitutional laws. People have some kind of right that is objectively true and should be protected. Why? Well, they're made in the image of God. but you remove all that, it's just like, no, we just are trying to create some kind of order. Well, why do we prioritize order? Why is order better than chaos? Because that's a moral judgment if you're going to say this is better than this. Objectively. Oh, we're back to objectives. You see what I'm saying? Anyway, so it's all in a big cycle. And all of it comes down to the topic of what we're going to talk about today. I also was in Christian education. I did homeschooling. I was in Christian school, homeschooling in elementary, Christian school in high school, public school for law school, and then I went to Christian college. So I hit all of them. And now we currently homeschool ours, and we'll very likely put them in Christian school once we get tapped out of homeschooling. But we'll see. So education, before we get into a defense of Christian education, we should define education. What is it? How many of you are already educators, just out of curiosity? Or how many of you are going to be, or you're somehow involved in some kind of education, but you're not a direct educator? Is that pretty much everybody in here? How many of you are not any of those things? You're just interested in the topic. Okay. So most of you are very, very, very involved in it. Well, I found some great definitions that I love what they tell us about the word and the, what we should be doing in education. You likely know the etymology of education is Latin, educare. Who knows if that's how it's pronounced? Anybody a Latin teacher in here? Good. So you probably don't even know. Educare is how you pronounce it, maybe. And it means to bring up or to bring forth or to bring out what is within. Now, I love that definition. That education is to bring out or bring up what is within. And I think we already started at a Christian place, because we are made in the image of God. So we have God's image in us that is instilled with all these abilities. And to educate is to bring those out, maybe to hone them, to enhance them, or to teach you how to do it for some kind of purpose. It's the process by which society transmits its accumulated or shared knowledge, skills, values, that's a huge one, from one generation to the other. Now, these aims of this may be vastly different depending upon where you are and what the worldview is, but it can include development of understanding, how you understand the world, rationality and reasonable thinking, even kindness and honesty and other moral values. Education, to bring out or bring up or bring forth what is within. There's one Christian educator, I don't like all of his stuff, Piper, who maybe run into different things that he's done, but he did an education, it was like a seminar or something where they were talking about Christian education, and several of them got their heads together and decided to do a definition of Christian education. And I think is fantastic. I think they really hit the nail on the head. And this is worth writing down if you're an educator. To think of a definition of education, what it is. First, we'll start with what would be true for all educators, regardless of your worldview, and then how it would be different if we're going to come from a Christian perspective. So education is instilling habits of mind and heart. Education is instilling habits. All these words are so well chosen because they all hit to different parts of education. Instilling habits of mind and heart that incline students for the rest of their lives to do the following. So we're trying to incline students for the rest of their lives or equip students for the rest of their lives to do these things. One, observe the world clearly. Right? The basis of that, you got to observe things and you know, see what's around you. Now, do it clearly. Two, understand what they have observed. That is really the beginning cornerstone of it. You have to, like, what am I looking at? And because a lot of people, to learn something or to persuade or to create or do anything with something, if you don't understand it, you're already limited on where you're going. Number three, evaluate what you have seen and understood. And evaluate it fairly. That's kind of that objective standard where I can actually come at something with an open mind and be able to decipher, what is an accurate way of looking at it. So evaluating, so observing, understanding, evaluating what you've seen and heard fairly. Number four, feel that evaluated reality proportionately. So how do you feel or interact with this evaluation of the understanding based on the observation that you've seen. Now, I know I'm in the weeds, and some of you are like, "Who am I already?" But you're educators; you can do this. Like, you got this. People who are well educated should not have big feelings and emotions towards insignificant, trivial matters. Right? Isn't that good? Actually, when you really think about it, if you're educated, you're not going to have big, strong emotions and feelings. Because we're emotive beings, and that's a huge part of our humanness, towards things that don't matter. And likewise, they don't have blasé, apathetic feelings and emotions towards vastly important matters, right? So that's a huge part of education that really is easy to miss, because we get stuck on the, oh, I'm just teaching them how to read or write, or even from a spiritual, I'm teaching them, specific truths about God. All that's education, but also that really processing. And by the way, the public education, this is a side note, but I think it's very good for educators. You're going to run into this. How many of you ever you have to do your, what are they called? Not CLEs, that's what we call them in law. Like your continuing education. Do you have to do any through the state, through secular sources ever? I know some states you do.
Yeah.
You'll notice more and more now, the public schools are actually honing in on this. They're really trying to help, because they're noticing especially the rise in issues with behavioral problems and the rise in a lot of the mental illness and things like that. And so they're really trying to tap into this. Now, I would argue once again, well-meaning, but they're not coming from a Christian worldview, so you're hitting all kind of interesting things and going into very false beliefs. But they recognize that this is very important, how you interact or feel about things. Number five in the definition, to apply these discoveries, these evaluations and feelings and how to interact with the evaluations, apply the discoveries wisely. because as you interact with truths around you in the world and how you're going to, what you're going to do with them, you need to figure out how to apply them to you and to others and do it in a way that is wise and careful and prudent. Number six, to express those realities clearly, accurately, winsomely, creatively, with your mouth, body, language, in the world, for the good of the world. This could be true for secular or sacred, or Christian sources. So the final one, to express those realities clearly, accurately, winsomely, creatively, with your mouth, body, writing, in the world, for the good of the world. That is the goal of education. You want to help instill these kids with habits of mind and heart that will incline them for the rest of their lives to observe the world clearly, understand what they've observed, evaluate what they've seen and understood fairly, to feel that evaluated reality proportionately, apply the discoveries wisely, and express these realities in all those different ways for the good of the world. When we are interacting with students, when we are educating, we are interacting with people made in the image of God who have really immense potential for good or bad in the world. And God has definite plans for them and plans for you and instructions for you in how to interact with those souls that you're dealing with. The people, every single one of us, we are creative beings. We were created to do things, to persuade. We're literally called to do that, to evangelize, to lead, to shepherd. All these, so many of the things we're called to do, they are action verbs and they require action. Why? Because we're beings of action, just like God is a God of action. And that's why he calls us to educate and be focused on how we interact with the next generation, with those people around us. And then I love the final one, for the good of the world, because there's a tagline that he sticks on at the end of that. We're going to do this for the good of the world, however you define it. Because if it's not Christian, well, what is the good? And, if you've ever studied Aristotle, he was obsessed with this question. The good, the virtue. Many of the Greeks and Roman writers were all talking about what is virtue? What is the good? And most educators, because most are unsaved, are going to come with their definition of what the good is, and they will then be focused on instilling that and will into the people that they're educating. And I think one main takeaway we can just stop and obviously point out here that most of you already know, or probably all of you already know, education is never neutral. It is always, you are indoctrinating. You are instilling something into the students, and it's going to be your worldview, and it's going to be based on what you believe to be good. Because if you were doing things that weren't good, that would make you a bad, evil person with evil motives, right? And that's really the tension, because where those two worldviews rub against each other is where a lot of the problems arise. As a side note, since I mentioned Aristotle, I don't think I mentioned this last time we were talking about it, but if you read Aristotle's Politics, He has this whole treatise on what an ideal city's like. And, people argue this is one of the smartest men that ever lived, created whole, subject matters like biology and botany and all these different things and literary criticism. I mean, just insanely smart guy. And so he was saying, what are the ideal subject matters that a city or a city state would teach to the students, right? And he had four. Now, if I didn't tell you any of that backstory, and I just said, what are the four key things, subject matters we should teach students? I have a feeling most people would immediately go like reading, writing, arithmetic, science, right? Or maybe history, right? It's the main subject matters, right? The subjects that we teach. Does anybody know what his were? It's not exactly, although it is included, as several of these are in one of them, and it's the first one. Rhetoric. Now, his idea of rhetoric, some people think rhetoric and they just think speech. Well, that was a huge part of it. actually. That is the main part of it. But within rhetoric is writing, persuasion, and morality would actually be included in there, because persuasion, you're persuading people to change behaviors or to change their way of thinking, which is a moral exercise. So rhetoric, number one. Number two is drawing. Right. Now, drawing can be defined different ways, not just like artistic, like I'm drawing a picture. Within their understanding, it would also have included some mathematics, like geometry and doing figures and things like that. So suddenly it makes more sense. It's not just, but actually art itself was the main part of the category as far as how we understood it. So rhetoric, drawing. Number three, music. Isn't that interesting? What are we talking about right now? It sounds like extracurriculars, doesn't it? And then number four, gymnastics. Yeah, right? It's just like, wait, what? Now, granted, we will admit that some of the subject matters weren't quite as developed as they are back then when he was writing this. But if you really stop and think about it, within a lot of what else Aristotle teaches and pushes, humans are creative. And the extracurriculars are actually creative enterprises. They teach children how to be creative and to express themselves in a way. And it kind of goes back to that other definition. You're not just learning facts, though learning facts is vitally important and you need to learn how to learn facts. But just learning facts about the world is not even remotely. In fact, I would say it is a subservient goal of education to teaching how to express yourself, how to engage successfully and morally in the world around you, for the good of the world, back to that definition. And so education is not just teaching facts or teaching how. It really is teaching how, why, and what to do with it. And that is why the worldview that you come with and the understanding of what the good is matters so much. So if we took that definition that we just said and said, okay, well, what would make it Christian? Well, it's pretty obvious. The why is what makes it Christian. It's for the good, the definition of the good. Well, what is the good of the world? The good of the world is to glorify God. So all of our education is for the intent and the purpose of glorifying God. And that really, if we zero in on some of the parts of that definition, it involves recognizing God in everything we said. Going back to the very beginning of observing the world. Well, we're observing a created world that works in all these different ways because there was a creator and they reflect the creator. Understanding what they're observed, what are we looking at, how did it get here, why is it here, for what purpose? All of those, if we try to secularize it, you're missing true, deep understanding of what we're looking at. So we've already messed up on the first two, let alone getting into evaluating what you've understood fairly and how to feel about them and interact with them, because now you're in totally wonky, false places because you didn't even start with understanding what you're actually looking at. If it's a Christian education, it's going to be missional, just as the secular education is, and the mission is to glorify God, and specifically following the real word of God, to preach Christ and to recognize, you know, the redemptive purpose and where we're going within the world that we currently live. So the building, creating, ordering is not for the glory of self or of humankind or the good of the whole, but it is ultimately for the glory of God. Worship, we're teaching worship, worshiping creator, not creation, stuff we've already talked about. And it's really based on revealed truth. Everything is revealed truth based on God, since he's the originator. And it's not trying to reveal inner truths or natural truths. Because if there are any inner truths or natural truths, which I'm kind of stepping on the Greeks now, because if you read that, it all sounds really good and actually sounds a lot better than a lot of secular stuff today, which if you read a lot of that, it's like, yeah, they're just totally off and they think we're all a bunch of monkeys and there's no absolutes. Well, the Greeks didn't believe that, but the Greeks were still, they were teaching a form of godliness that sounds real good and virtuous, and it's very close, but it's still missing the actual link to the Creator and to, you know, to Christ. And so, and that's where it misses. They teach, you hear a lot of the stuff of inner truth and natural truth. Well, the only way you have any inner truth or natural truth is just because it's God's revelation, and it falls within the framework of understanding Him. So we are called to teach the next generation, teach our children and the children around us the lives that we have to shepherd. And how are we supposed to do that? You remember the verse in Deuteronomy? Do we do it in a passive way? Do we do it sometimes? What's the verse? And thou shalt teach them diligently, which, by the way, that's a heavy word. And thinking about it as a parent, that's a heavy and convicting word. How many of your parents in here? Anybody have kids? Yeah, several of you. Well, if you don't, let me just tell you that it's a very convicting thing, a sobering thing, because let's step on millennials again. I think that more than ever, lazy parenting is becoming the norm. I think people are busy and stressed, and there's so much to deal with, and it's a little overwhelming. And so we've fallen into, in my parents' generation, I think they were much better at being choosy parents. You remember choosy moms, choose Jif? You remember that peanut butter slogan? Like that, everybody understood that back in the day. It's like, yeah, everybody wanted it. And now it really, when you look at entertainment and education and all these other things, everything except for food, we're really crunchy with food and health stuff. But other than that, it's like, give them a screen, not really sure the content, don't have bandwidth, don't want to stick taboos on things that I don't necessarily have to. My parents were too limiting. All I could watch was VeggieTales and listen to Patch the Pirate. So I'm going to break out. My kids, you know, who cares like what's out there? And one example of this, a little off topic, but not really. I think it all ties into defensive Christian education, because it's like, why do we need to worry about defending this structure, putting a lot of time, effort, and treasure, and organization, and talent. Let's go back to talent. Teachers going into this at a lower pay raise, because it is, it's a lot of sacrifice for people to have a Christian education system, a lot. And I know I'm preaching to the choir. But so is it actually worth it? Does it matter? Well, let's use the analogy. Is it worth parenting and putting a lot of time, effort, treasure, limitations on yourself and your family, or does it really not that matter? Is it not that big of a deal? Will it all work out in the end? Because once again, it sounds nice. You know, God's got it. Grace, under grace, the kids will be fine. Do I actually have to be diligent and watchful? Do I have to, actually purge things? And do I actually have to not do certain things that maybe are semi-harmless, but because of the potential effects on them? Well, I think the verse is pretty clear. Thou shalt teach them, this is talking about the things of God, God's law. Teach them diligently unto thy children, and shall talk of them when thou sittest in thy house, when thou walkest by the way, when thou liest down, and when thou risest up. So like literally at all times of day, in mundane moments, in intentional teaching times, we're supposed to be teaching them diligently, specifically of God and his and how he's revealed his truth to us. So if we apply that to education, it's the exact same thing. We are called to teach children diligently the things of God, who God is, in pretty much all interactions, whether it's in curriculum, whether it's outside of curriculum, your interactions with the kids, you're, shepherding their heart and pointing them to God. We already talked about education is the passing down of values and abilities to the next generation. The kids are sponges. They're taking on everything. So what values are we passing on to them? What are we worshiping is the ultimate question. So, because what we talk about, what we derive pleasure from and delight in, what we think about, what we spend our time on, that's what we're worshiping. So, if God's never on our lips, we're not worshiping God. If in our instruction time, all we do is talk about God's revealed world, and He never comes up in it whatsoever. He doesn't even. There's no moment at which we actually think of God or speak of God. Well, God is absent from it. And so we need to be intentional to bring God into the instruction, specifically instruction with children. So really quickly, though, since this is always important when you're talking about any subject, we're trying to defend it. So what are the objections against Christian education? Anybody have any? What are objections that you hear or that you've thought of or that you've heard people voice about Christian education, that like it's really not worth it? And these could be as serious or as goofy and silly as you've heard. Like, legitimately, what are the objections?
All the time I get, your children won't be properly socialized.
Yeah, and As somebody who's been through it, I can think that's silly. But actually, if that's a potential, my kids aren't going to be properly socialized. What does that mean? That's a whole other session, unpacking properly socialized. Those words are heavy.
I generally argue with them that when they go to school, they learn to socialize with children, but what they really need is to learn how to socialize with adults.
Mm, yeah.
And they get that at church, and they get that at home, and they get that at the store.
But the fear being that if we cloister them away in some kind of very sterile environment, they won't be able to, they won't have resiliency. Thinking of educators' terms, right? I mean, sure, you probably heard this kind of stuff. And if you lock a child away, they have very few interactions. They don't understand how the world works. They don't understand, certain things at appropriate ages, right? As you start, because as you age, you do grow to understand what is deceit. What do I watch for interactions with bad behaviors from other people? How do I navigate manipulation? How do I understand? All that stuff's legit. But so if you lock them away and they don't have any of that, yeah, that would be a big concern. But is a Christian education system actually doing that? And what are we actually talking about? What are they really getting to? Is it that they're not going to be able to appropriately navigate the world and interact in a normal way with other humans? Or is it that they don't think that they mesh within a certain culture? And is it a very secular, is it basically they don't want it to be weird? Like, they don't want them to understand cultural references. They don't want them to be able to, understand and make jokes that, other kids would. Because that's really, if you think about it, that's probably the only argument that they've got. Because if you look objectively at how the kids do, they are kids that are homeschooled in Christian school are in every single line of work, every single profession that's out there. They actually do better at testing, at going into most of the professions. And they don't seem to have a hard time getting a job or getting married. So if all that's true, they can get a job and they seem to be pretty healthy. Is it an actual false objection? You seem to think definitely.
Yeah, for the most part. I mean, there are a couple homeschool families that give them a little bit of ammo for that.
Yeah. Yeah. And we've all seen them, right? Yeah. Did somebody have...
I think also you got to remember that that the purpose behind, you raising your children and whatnot, people have different intentions on how they want to raise their children. Mm-hmm. And sometimes not everybody has a biblical view of raising their children. So having a Christian, going into a Christian education is like, well, that doesn't really match with what I want for my child.
For the good. How they're defining it. Yeah.
They'll look at a Christian education and say, that doesn't really match what I want for my children. Well, what is it that you want?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And really, going back to tying those two together and thinking about it, if somebody doesn't, they think the kid is kind of just a little off, not as socially with it. Well, they're defining the good as somebody that's very, very adaptable and easily navigates most social situations. And that would be their highest. Well, somebody else may come and say, I really don't care if my kid is maybe a little off to some people in certain cultural standpoints. I care more about something else, some kind of religious. Or I would think, can't you do both? Because I think the answer is yes. And I don't think you have to sacrifice. But that is an objection. Like we said, there are some stereotypes that may give into it. And really, at the root of it is that. What specifically is the end goal? Because if somebody really wants their kid I'll jump off that soapbox. But okay, any others?
Objection would be that it would be an inferior.
Yeah, inferior education.
It's taught by people who don't actually understand whether it's math or science or you just believe the Bible, therefore because you do that, you can't understand.
Yeah.
You can't understand science.
Yeah, you're not as intelligent because you're accepting, you're choosing to ignore scientific truth, as they would say it, and therefore you can't possibly educate well. The teacher's instruction is not as credentialed. The educational and extracurricular opportunities are not as funded or available. Right, a lot of this stuff is semi-accurate in the latter two. The first one's laughable because if you've interacted with teachers from the public school, you know that that's not true.
So here I was And my child had brought home, you know, we go through an accelerated Christian education, and they brought this problem home, and they said, "Dad, I'm supposed to solve the square root." And I don't have a math degree or anything, right? But I'm reasonably competent in a lot of math. And I was like, "You can't solve a square root. You push it on your calculator." I didn't realize that you can actually solve a square root. There's a process to, you know what I mean? I didn't know. I was completely ignorant of that. And so, you know, it's a very false argument.
Yeah, it is. I'm going to argue that it absolutely is a false argument. And once again, the easiest way to debunk that one is, well, look at the product. Are there kids that go through and have an inferior education in certain private schools? Yes. In certain homeschools? Yes. In certain public schools? Yes. And if you look at it objectively based on the testing, the argument, they are actually in a tougher spot than we are defending Christian education. We're actually going to put them back up to, you know, together. And the private and homeschool education is actually going to be superior. The kids are going to test better, which is the objective standard of looking at it, than public. And now there's one kids in public that do great, and kids everywhere that the systems work for them. But on a whole, the objection is it's an inferior education. Well, it's just simply not. And I ran into this in law school. I had a teacher tell me we would regularly. I was his favorite student until he found out that I went to Bob Jones. He didn't know I was an undergrad. I was his favorite student. He would call me all the time. We would joke about things. I would answer more questions than a lot of the other people, and we just would hit it off. Our personalities clicked, and he was this very funny, like super strong, stereotypical New York Jewish, like clerked for, I don't even remember, one of the Supreme Court, one of the ones back in the day, just funny, this super thick accent. And we would go back and forth all the time. And then the day he found out I was from Bob Jones, it all changed. It was like, and he said in front of everybody, "Oh, wow, I didn't know you're from there." Yeah, I find that students from there struggle in my classes. And I'm like, I'm in one of the top grades in your class right now. And he's like, "Yeah, because they can't understand moral ambiguities. They can't deal with gray areas. Everything's got to be black and white." And so, yeah, that's just hard when you're coming from there. And it's just like, how ignorant for him, for you to like assume. But it's like that. But he's comparing the two worldviews. It's like, well, one is mentally or intellectually inferior in his mind. And so that's where a lot of it comes from. Going back to, oh well, you're ignoring objective scientific truth, and you're believing, you know, a fairy tale. And so that is really the crux of it. Is that worldview is tainting it, and so you have they just automatically assume it's inferior. But let's ignore the facts, which are that the private and homeschool is actually superior based on outcomes. Any others?
Well, kind of going along with that, having taught them both. I got with my students, other kids from public school thought we were raising them to be better, thought of themselves as being better.
And so it's like maybe hitting the opposite way, like teaching some elitism, some arrogance. Yeah, and that's not always as easy to deal with. That one's a little more subversive. Yeah, and that actually hits to one that's a regular, isn't it elitist and classist for private education? Because a lot of private education you have to pay for. And so some people just do not have the opportunities to have it. And so some people make a fairness argument that it's not right, in relation to fairness, to have some people have the benefits of private education and others not. And so they want to change it where everybody has to have the same.
Vouchers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So people can, yeah, and that's really, I would argue, the ideal system, but I don't want to get into all that because people have different opinions on it, and it's apart from what we're talking about today. But yes, my argument would be that the making it so that parents can choose and choose whatever option is best for the child is best, and then that would be my argument for everybody. And then my argument for Christians is get your kids out of the public school. And if you want to go into the public school, you personally, as a mission field, go for it, because we need good people in it. But don't put your kids in it. That would be my argument, or personal opinion, we'll say. let's see, what else is there? And the argument fundamentally, the answer to that one is the fairness argument. Let's say you don't have vouchers. And then does the whole argument fall apart because, oh, it's not fair and some kids will get it and some kids won't? Sorry, the whole, like, the reality is our system is based on that. Certain people are born with more talents than others. Certain people are born with certain privileges over others. And some people are naturally smarter. Some people are more attractive. Some people are whatever. And the reality is you have to use whatever abilities you have and do the best you can. And to try to manufacture or force sameness is actually the very root and end goal of communism. And we've seen that attempted. And even those kind of structures being forced in all sorts of various societies, wherever they're tried, it ruins whatever it touches. And that's because it actually tears down this ideal of excellence and pursuit of better and forces some kind of lower standard of sameness. And if you, and that, really getting off topic, but it's so interesting, so I'll just footnote it. John Adams had a fascinating book, and I'm blanking on the title of it, but he had a philosophy of, it rubbed people the wrong way in his time because they thought he was so elitist. And he would always argue this, that basically having people that are better than you in life is actually good. Having social betters, having whatever, because they show a different standard that you could potentially attain to. And every single person is different and has different interests and abilities and skills. And it's the people that use their time, talents, and treasure for those pursuits that actually elevate everybody or ennoble everybody in those areas of pursuits. I want somebody that's smarter than me. I want a doctor who's a whole lot smarter at me in medicine, right? I want a stockbroker that's a whole lot more educated and knows what they're doing in stocks than I do. Even goofy stuff. Like if you think of how things look, like my wife is she likes design and stuff like that. I don't. I couldn't care less about it. But then when she is following somebody or you know, gets this idea of some way of organizing or, how would you say that, appointing our house in a certain kind of way, you see it and it's like, wow, this space looks better. I'm more mentally stable in it. Like I can think more clearly. It's naturally more beautiful. Like that comes from somebody that actually has education and taste better than mine, because I wouldn't know what to do with it. And suddenly I can appreciate the beauty of something in almost kind of a silly area, like design or aesthetics, we'll say, or architecture. You want people that have disposable incomes more than you and that taste to then use that and ennoble all of us in that area to have more beautiful things in our world. And so actually the having inequalities is actually a good for society. That's what Adams argued. And Rousseau argued the exact opposite, the underpinnings of communism, that the inequalities are the biggest problems in the world. And it's this manufactured institutions that hold people back. Some of those manufactured institutions were religion and education and the family structure and on and on and on, representative government. But anyway, so we need to just get rid of all those and go back to the noble savages, which is where we all live in this kind of commune society. But the terrible root of the truth of it is when we talk about the role, the topic at hand, the defense of Christian education, you really kind of hit at those two different worldviews, because Rousseau's, we'll say a perversion of the classical liberalism, really hits to this idea that humanity is perfectible, that humanity at its root is good. People are at their root good. And if we just inform them and educate them and have somebody that really knows and has the good taste to organize and order this and force this sameness, then we'll all have this utopian society in the future. That's the goal of liberalism, understood. Now, I'm not talking about political liberalism, though I would make arguments there, but just talking about as far as philosophy. Conservatism was the exact opposite. It's based on recognizing that mankind is evil at its root. Yes, we're made in the image of God, but something went wrong. And actually, government and the structures that we have, whether religious and familial and moral taboos, those are all meant to stop bad behavior that will happen because people will abuse other people's rights. And so fundamentally, like, and we have to have some way of fixing this system apart from ourselves. So you have two vastly different worldviews. And one is, I would argue, very strongly rooted biblically. And one has things that you can find in the Bible, but it's for a future state when we know, when we don't have sin anymore. And so they come up with a philosophy thinking that they can do it apart from how God has revealed to deal with it. And so that is the main crux. You have these two completely vastly polarized worldviews, and secular education today is rooted in the utopian worldview of secular humanism that we can perfect ourselves apart from God. And the biblical worldview is, no, you can't. God isn't everything. You're a sinner. And your interactions with the world are meant for his glory and to understand things within a framework and understanding of his revealed truth. So vastly different. And that's why, really, it matters so much. I'm running out of time, but I really want to get into the objections of public education. The other objection that you regularly will run into from 6 years sitting on the education committee, anytime somebody came in to criticize private education, and this could be Jewish schools, Catholic schools, just generic private that's non-religious, homeschooling, they would come in and basically be arguing they're indoctrinating, and that's wrong. You're indoctrinating these kids, you're poisoning minds with what you think, with what their parents or with what some kind of worldview wants on them, and that's wrong. They should have a neutral, objective education. So that, yeah, exactly. Well, but I will actually say, in my opinion, that is the main objection to private schooling in the secular world. And I think that you'll run into it in government, and you'll run into it from public educators. Now, they might phrase it differently to you if they know that you're a Christian educator, but that's really where everything else is just trying to get more people on board. Like, oh yeah, and it's subpar. Oh yeah, and it's not fair because some kids get, you know, but really the crux of it is they're worried about indoctrination into, in their mind, some kind of inferior belief system. But you've already hit the nail on the head, and we've already talked about it. All education is indoctrination. You are teaching your worldview. We all are. We all naturally persuade all day. Like, that's what we do. Were you going to say something? And I saw some hands over here, too.
Recognize that. Shows that they're inferior.
Yeah.
They don't have the intellectual acumen to realize that they're no moral absolutes. It's an absolute.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. In and of itself, yeah. Mm-hmm.
They're not indoctrinating. They're showing themselves that their level of education is much lower. They don't understand something that basic.
Yeah.
Everyone indoctrinates.
Everyone indoctrinates. And so the more we talk about that, the more I think it helps the situation. And I'll get to specific things you can do, action items, but I also want to take questions. We only have 7 minutes, but I'm also very interested in what y'all have to say. I do have, let me make sure I'm not missing anything very important. I wanted to talk about the objections to public education because I've lived it and know them from the inside. And then I want to talk about what educators or people that are in the field can do to better interact with their government, because the government is who is going to continue regulating you, and we've got to get more organized and more on point and tie up the defense. But I feel like we've already defended it. We can go to the other things.
So what you just said about Christian educators indoctrinating, that's the argument, that actually could be very true in some ways, where if you send your kids to a Christian school or homeschool or whatever, and that's all you teach them, then when they're in high school, go work at Taco Bell or something, somebody has this fact.
Yeah, you're leaving them unprepared.
Oh, I never heard that side of it before, because a lot of times they only will teach, evolution is the big one that comes to mind. A lot of times they only teach creation. Well, evolution has its own merit in some ways, because parts of it are true, like things adapt over time. Mm-hmm. Like, that's true. But if you don't address that right, and somebody comes with this, you're like, oh,
you leave them unprepared, really, for the objections toward their faith that are going to come. That kind of goes back to resiliency.
I teach public school. I had a kid come in from a very, very conservative, strict Catholic school. First day, it's a pretty rough school I'm at. There was a fight in the hallway. Kids were cussing and stuff like that. Kid came to me, big eyes, like, I don't know what to do. He had no idea how to, like, deal with that kind of difference in his life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's terrible. And it's like,
I don't think that responsibility is on an educator. I think that that really comes from the parents.
Yeah, you mean what one? Sorry.
Like,
oh yes.
Showing them like, you know, that difference. Because yeah, I teach about school too, and there are, I've had a couple of kids come in like they are just wild, and they are. Like, all these public kids are wild, but I think that there is education that's needed for parents, like about Christian parents, like teaching their children like about the world, about not that they have to experience the world, but just about the things of the world, because
to be prepared. Really, wise as serpents and harmless as doves, and be ready to be prepared to give an account, because that really is, you know, we have the gospel and we have all these things in the Bible that answers to these problems, but if you are woefully ignorant of main objections that people are going to bring, then you can run into a crisis of faith or just be ignorant and lose the ability to testimony to be able to have impact if you're unprepared. I would say for Christian educators, it's probably more easily a burden to task on them because they're the ones interacting with the subject matters. Like they're the ones that can teach. If they're a science teacher in a Christian school, they're going to make a decision. Am I going to teach evolution? And I'd say you should at least be preparing them what it is, the basic facts, so that they know how to interact with it. And being in public is a totally different animal. It's because like, how do you, and there's a way to do it. How do you do all of this within the public school, trying as much as you can to teach them a Christian worldview that is allowable and within what is legal?
And you'd be surprised how many public school children actually believe a lot of the Christian values and morals and don't even know that they are Christian values and morals. In some way, somehow, they've been taught these things. They just don't recognize them. I've given a lot of my kids scripture and things like that. Like, oh, I kind of know about that. Or, oh, yeah, that makes sense. Because it does. Like, the Bible works. The Bible is, you know, the gospel is truth. So, you know, when they see the fallacies of the world that they're actually living in, it's like, it's an eye-opener for them.
Yeah. It gives a lot of opportunity. Yeah. Yeah, well, the other main objections I had for public education specifically relate to things that I saw on the committee firsthand. One of was the quality of education, and you have some great educators, and you have some great, you know, programs and curriculums, but you also have terrible educators, just like you would anywhere, but the number of complaints received, and some of it is the way that the structure is set up for like the inability, and in different states can be different ways, but South Carolina specifically, they can't get rid of a bad teacher. If there's a bad teacher and at a bad school, and there's so many failing schools, we're talking where in South Carolina, certain schools where no one is on grade level for reading or math. And they require everybody to do, like all the schools have to do these tests. There's no private schools that are at that state, but there's multiple public schools that are. And within the system, even though that's true, they still get all their funding. They're not allowed to get rid of the bad teachers. And then when they finally go to change something, like to get rid of the school board or something in that area, or to try to do major fixes, it's lawsuits, it's red tape, it's this huge, and there's nothing they can do. So basically you have whole areas of the state that are failing all the kids in there, and the parents are forced or in the position where they have to send them there because they don't provide them any vouchers or any other options. So unless they take the financial hit, which many do, to get them out of the system, they are automatically in an environment, kind of what you were describing, where it not only is an oppressive and an inferior learning environment just from the curriculum and the teaching skills and abilities, but the actual, I mean, how do you learn in a situation where you've got kids screaming at each other, fighting, like you're at constant fear? It just is kind of crazy because it just, you think that there's nothing healthy about that. And talk about getting you ready for the world. Like that's not actually not normal. Like, it really is. Yes, that happens, but it's like getting you ready for prison, not getting you ready for... Anyway, just saying. Anyway, so seeing a lot of that firsthand and the complaints and the issues that were coming, especially from the teachers and what was going on in the class, and from very well-meaning teachers talking about the state of education. And like you said, a lot of this is a home problem. You've got parents who are not disciplining the kids at home, and so they're just sending these, you know, just wild children for teachers to try to do something with for the limited time they have. And unfortunately, public gets it worse, because if you've already made the choice for private, you probably are investing a little more time in your kids' development at home, which means it's likely more stable. Not always, but likely more stable. And you've, especially if you're paying into it, you're at least have some skin in the game. So public school teachers, I do believe, have it worse with all that. But anyway, can be unsafe environment physically, morally, socially. The ideological coercion that you run into, especially if you're coming from a Christian perspective, I was blown away. We would have these hearings talking about, there's so many big issues that happened when I was there that were going through. A lot of the trans stuff, and the counseling kids on the state time to figure out gender dysphoria and all that. And they were, you know, talking about the kids' gender identity and not disclosing it to the parents, and even encouraging them to transition while they were at school and not telling the parents that they're which is crazy. You have a very serious issue going on, regardless of what you believe about that issue. A kid is questioning their gender and wanting to transition. That's a huge, big deal that the parents should be aware of. And the fact that the teachers were actively, we had teachers that came into our committee yelling at us for daring to encroach upon their ability to help kids. They were their only safe space in their lives. The parents, they can't tell their parents anything, so they have to help them navigate this and transition the way that they feel appropriate. And I remember in the committee hearing one day, one of my friends who's a Democrat, we voted differently on everything that we ever voted on, but she was floored. And she said, jumped in and was like, I'm sorry, you're talking to a child about their, you know, sexual preference at school? And not telling the parents about it, and this is a seventh grader or sixth grader, whatever it was, and the person just brazenly was like, "Yes, I'm their only safe space, and I'm the one." Blah blah, and to think that is out there, and you have no control whether or not that's going to be your kid's teacher, and so I just that kind of stuff, seeing that regularly, and I could tell you lots of other stories if I had time, I would, but I won't because we're out of time. Anyway, the impact of children. Their education on children is immense. Everybody knows this. Their identity, their morality, worldview, their understanding of what their purpose is being shaped in their educational experiences. Teachers are naturally put on a pedestal. They're trusted. In fact, they're viewed, a lot of kids, especially as they age, view their teachers as more intelligent than their parents. If you think about it, it makes sense. You put them on the pedestal. They're there to teach you stuff, right? And your parents know stuff, but their teachers are the experts on this. So they think of them as more intelligent even. So if you have a contradiction of how the world works, are you going to listen to the person that you love and that you trust, or the person that's smarter? Well, actually, a lot of people are going to say, well, I probably should listen to the person that's smarter. So once again, the setting forth the importance of making sure that you are aligned with your kids' educators. Everything within the system is set to conform someone's worldview to whatever the worldview is of the instructor or the curriculum or system. We already know we're not supposed to be conformed to the world, so we should be... we should be specifically intent on teaching kids diligently from God's truth. And I'm out of time. There's so much more stuff that I wanted to talk about. As a side note, we're talking about education and how their kids' worldview is conformed or formed so much from their education. Their entertainment is sometimes an even bigger driver. And so going back to the lazy parenting, if you think the education that your kids... are getting from the entertainment, the values, and all that stuff, it's having immense impact. But we're over time. So in conclusion, I will argue that Christian education is not just a luxury or not just a nice side project or thing that you could engage in. I would say it's a spiritual responsibility, regardless of what system you're in. Even if you're in the public education, like the public educators that are in the room, or if you were in it, you find yourself. I went to law school. There really weren't any Christian law school options, or very few. The goal there is really the same. It's just you have to figure out, it's harder to navigate. And if you are one of those that is in Christian education, I applaud you for your efforts. Can't tell you how grateful many of us are that you're in it. And after living through, so personally, the public education system, it's so incredibly needed. It's worth the time, talent, and treasure that you or your ministries pour into it. And so continue to go forth. And the last things that I'll mention, because now we're 5 minutes over, you need to engage with politics. Not that you need to be teaching politics and talking about political stuff in the classroom. That's not what I'm saying at all. You need to be organized as a school and as teachers, as educators, in interacting with your county and your state governments. You know, federal, maybe. Honestly, it doesn't matter that much. Your state governments are who are having direct authority over you in all 50 states in this country. And so the traditional wisdom was just duck and cover for homeschooling and private schooling, right? We're worried about getting regulated, so just basically hide from. That is the dumbest thing you could do. As a former, 6 years in elected office, served in the House of Representatives, who shows up has the influence and impact, regardless of what their worldview is, because they're your constituents. And if you are a school, wherever you are located, and go home and tell this, if you're not the principal and you have one, that principal should be interacting regularly with their legislator. They should know you're there. They should come see your school. Even if you're like, no, but they might regulate. No, they're going to see, I'm telling you, from a legislative perspective, it's like, oh, all of these constituents and voters, and like, these are in my districts, and I want to keep them happy, and I want to know them. And regardless of what party they're from, like, they're writing the policy. You need to be interacting with them. You need to be giving them information about the benefits of the programs, how many families are there, and engaging, and just even just writing a quick thing like, hey, there's a bill coming up that's talking about regulating, you know, how a voucher works, or what kind of credentials a teacher, even in private school, has to have. I don't think we should do that for this reason. Like, that's it. You've got to engage. Because the more, I will argue that the reason we're actually at a better place on this is because some people finally understood it and started engaging. But there's still a massive lack as I interact with private educators. I heard so much more from public education and public educators and the students and the parents than I ever did from private or homeschool. One time, homeschool really got organized and got a whole thing changed in South Carolina because they were trying to shut it down. And they, but the private educators were just absent, completely absent. Never heard from them, almost ever. No organization. And they would get talked about all the time, but they were never there for the discussion. So that needs to change, and I would encourage you to do that. It's so easy. Literally just find out who your state house rep is. They rarely get interacted with. Contact them. Go get coffee with them. Email them. Invite them to your school and voice your opinions on things in a very nice way, and you will be shocked at the impact you can have. So I'm over. I got to let you go. So thank you all so much for coming. Let me pray, and then we'll get out of here. Lord, we thank you for who you are. We thank you that you have a high calling for all of us, that we are made in your image, and that we have the ability to interact with the next generation, these image bearers of you. And I pray for empowerment in this area. Help us to be good stewards of the lives that you place in our lives. Help us to be a light in this dark world and to do everything for your honor and glory. In Jesus' name we pray, amen.